Hi, guys. We are so excited to tell you about our sponsor today. Maltanon Movies is being brought to you by Legion M, and it's the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They are some of the nicest people, and they do lots of really cool things like fan meetups, events all over the country. They really make it fun for anybody who's a part of the Legion.
You can actually own a piece of a movie, and it doesn't cost a fortune to do it. Find out more at www.legionm.com. Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And we are both, Jesse and I, thinking back exactly 10 years, although our guest will correct that or amend that in a moment, to when I first was told I was going to interview for Disney Magazine the star of the next or the second Chronicles of Narnia movie, Prince Caspian. And I was going to get to talk to the fellow who was actually going to play Prince Caspian. And that's who's sitting here right now, 10 years later. It's Ben Barnes.
Hello.
And welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So it's longer ago?
I think it's a little bit longer because I was 25 when we shot that film, 26 mm-hmm. when it came out. I'm 37 now, so I think it's probably 11 years.
But 10 is a cleaner number, so
it's much
we're
cleaner.
Go with
it's
that.
Exactly 10 years
10
ago.
10 years ago.
10 years today.
Our favorite yes. thing is that, you know, movies, it used to be 20th anniversary, 30th. Now it's like, it's the 23rd anniversary of blah, blah, blah the next year. It's the 24th anniversary of blah, blah.
No, you don't, you're not allowed right. one until the 25th. You can have one 25th, and then you have to wait till 50.
I like yeah. Though yeah. Twilight just met up because it's the 10 year anniversary, and I thought, did we need to meet up for the 10-year anniversary? Apparently we did. Apparently yes, we did. Yes. But hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks.
We're happy to have you.
Happy to be here.
What was that experience like? It was not an early movie experience for you in the first place, but it was such a big production.
Yeah, it was. It was one of my first film experiences. I think I'd done only two films before that, mm-hmm. a very small mm-hmm. indie low budget one, which was really enjoyable in the most indie kind of way, in a kind of, you know, no trailers or anything. I literally remember getting changed in red British phone boxes.
Perfect.
Like, a la Superman, actually.
Right?
I mean, not that quickly, but I remember getting changed in the phone boxes with crew standing around the edges so...
To protect your dignity?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
That film, and then I did a film called... Oh, no, actually, before that film, I did a film called Stardust.
Stardust, yes, to which we will return.
Okay. And then I went back and did some theatre for a year or two, and then... And then I think one of the casting directors saw me in a play actually in London, and then I auditioned for the film and a few times and flew out to New Zealand. But it did feel like an extraordinary leap forwards and upwards and sideways.
How long was the shoot? Do you remember?
I was in New Zealand for about 6 or 8 weeks, and then we were in Prague for about 6 more months. It was a very long shoot. It was about a 7-month shoot, I think.
Wow.
The first month I wasn't shooting very much, but I was staying in a place called Paradise on the South Island of New Zealand, learning to ride horses with, I had about 3 Spanish horse trainers, Ricardo and Ricardo, Hernan, and those were the main two. Mm-hmm. And I remember them very vividly because they were so wonderful. And I said I knew how to ride a horse. I know this is a very old sort of Hollywood fable that you say you know how to do things. But I said, I didn't lie. I said, I have ridden a horse before. And I did have proof because I remember my mum gave me this picture, which I think I actually took onto like a talk show, actually Jay Leno or something, and I showed it. But it was me on a Shetland pony, age 5 or something. And I had not been on a horse since. And I remember that I learned in New Zealand, there was in Auckland, I think there was the riding center for the disabled. And there was nobody there except me, not having any idea how to ride a horse. And then the producers came down on the second day and said, Ben, come here. It looks like the horse is riding you. and I died a little bit inside. But we got quite good because then I was sent off to Spanish horse riding and sword fighting camp while they filmed the first sort of 3 weeks of the film. And then most of my stuff was in Prague.
Spanish horse riding camp.
In New Zealand.
In New Zealand. Yep. That's the, see, and now this we know is, that's a thing.
This is why.
And now we know
this
that's
is why
thing.
Life felt forwards, upwards, and right. upside down.
You know, Jesse, think global.
Right. No, what I'm picturing in my head is the CG is that you're actually on a Shetland pony, and then they just CG'd in a horse, so that
well,
you'd be okay.
Well, little did I know, the next few years of my life would be a lot of time acting with tennis balls on the
right.
top of
right,
on
right,
the
right.
top of pool cues, and then we graduated by the third film to sort of laser. Pointers. We would follow laser pointers along green screens, and that is I longed for the tennis ball.
I just wanted.
I longed for one of our fabulous dwarf actors to
right.
be running around in a blue lycra suit, waving a tennis ball rather than this laser pointer, which was supposed to represent a dragon. It was impossible.
What are you credited as when you're the guy with the laser pointer?
I think it's just the first AD.
But because I really want to know what it is exactly that it would be, like head laser technician?
I seem to remember it was usually the first AD because he had a very loud voice to tell you where to look, because oftentimes we'd have three or four of us looking off the bow of the ship up and left, and one person would be looking down and right. What are you looking at? I saw a mermaid, actually.
Right.
So, I saw a mermaid. That's what
it's
I was...
It's called imagination, guys. Yeah. I'm
did
looking
they,
at whatever
did
I want.
Did they show you storyboards so you would have some sense of the scene?
I do remember the sort of production offices when you would arrive would be... That was something I'd never experienced on, mm-hmm. of course, in theatre or on any of these other movies, because I hadn't been involved from the inception. And so you'd turn up in these production offices, they'd have this wonderful artwork on the walls. It wasn't so much storyboards, although I'm sure they had that, but they had beautiful paintings, essentially, mm-hmm. of various beasts and kings in armor, and those they would just that's the kind of stuff I think that when you first step onto the set of a large scale movie that you cannot begin to fathom. That's the stuff to me that even on film tours, it doesn't matter how many studio tours you do, you don't get to see that stuff.
Yeah.
The first little swatches of material that they're going to use to make this cloak that features in the end, or the leather handle of this sword that they haven't attached the blade to yet, or this painting of a dragon, which is a pet. It's clearly it's artwork,
mm-hmm.
and I never know what happens to any of it. But
well, that's what's fascinating to me is that those are just components,
mm-hmm.
Tiny pieces.
Exactly, they're means to an end, to put it in a kind of mundane way, but that's what they are. They're not really meant to be seen by the public, and often aren't. And yet they're done with such skill and such artistry. No one just puts up a hasty sketch. They really render these pieces. And if you've ever seen any of it in some of the making of books or videos, you know what I'm talking about, folks. It's dazzling. It's just dazzling.
Especially and I've been very lucky to work in the fantasy realm a few times, particularly in film, obviously, which is where the budgets are.
Right.
And I think that's a particularly special sort of realm to live in terms of mm-hmm. all of that, all mm-hmm. of the accoutrements and all of
right.
the stuff that goes along.
Had you, now again, this is at the beginning of your film career, what was it like being away from home, so far from home, first in New Zealand, which of course is a beautiful,
some Spanish
beautiful.
Guys in a camp.
What a beautiful country, though.
Yes,
it was. It was interesting because those first few weeks felt quite solitary. I mean, because it was in New Zealand, and the rest of the cast and crew were on the North Island, and I was doing this training with these guys, and we would go off for these long 4 or 5 hour just rides. Hmm. And it's through these forests, and it was just fantastic. And then when we met up again and sort of started the film in earnest, it actually had a wonderful family vibe, not only because they'd already completed one film, which had been a success, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, of course, but there was a family vibe. Everyone's parents were on set because the kids were still mm-hmm. in school and going off to trailers, so they kept very reasonable hours, which is something I found out later, not all films are 9 to 5. But it was just a lovely environment. I was very much adopted as the kind of older brother, young uncle, depending on the age of the kid. But Will mm-hmm. Poulter, who was in the third film with me and went on to do some extraordinary films. Detroit is the latest one that I've seen him in. But
he keeps playing American. People do not know American. He's English. No. They do not know.
No, and he still calls me Uncle Benji. But neither of us. I haven't played British in 10 years.
See, oh my gosh!
I'm actually playing British right now for the first time.
They're just going to say in life.
10 years. No, I'm actually
playing British as myself right now.
Yeah,
but you've done two things. It sounds like you do accents. Like you like, maybe you're a little bit of a mimic.
Well, I did start to, not necessarily impressions, but certainly accents was always, for me, a place to start. Mm-hmm. How does this person sound is a really good first step to take. And I think a lot of people might start. I think I once heard about Daniel Day-Lewis talking about movement and the character's walk, and some people I've heard talk about how they can't really feel like the character until they're wearing what they're going to be wearing.
Costume, yep.
And so they go on these long walks in the costumes to have it soak into their skin, as it were. And for me, it was always, how does this person sound? So actually, playing something that was in my own sort of quite neutral London accent, which I thought people would find boring and nasal and irritating, I was actually quite worried about it, which I think is one of the reasons I haven't done it in such a long time. I sort of wanted to build a skill set and build some experience and confidence before being able to tackle something a bit closer to myself without worrying that people would find it bland.
P.S. We don't.
No.
We're typical Americans. Well, we're suckers.
No. This is why I moved suckers. To America, so I could be slightly more exotic.
Oh, please. I always, our listeners have heard me say this many times. My parents cannot understand my husband. Bless his Mancunian heart. They 99% of the time do not know what he's saying.
No one can understand someone from Manchester.
Okay, look, he's not a chap, so we're not going that deep. But no, it is an amazing thing. I'm fascinated speaking to different people about the various British accents because there are so many and they're so specific.
And they change geographically so
every
quickly.
Inch.
You know, you're in Manchester, and then you suddenly you're over in Liverpool where they're talking like that. And then you're in Ireland and you slip over and it's incredible how they do it.
And what I started to learn, say specifically with the UK, was it had to do a lot with the factories and not opening your mouth very much. That was one of the first people who ever said that to us was Melanie Linsky. Mm-hmm. Melanie Linsky was doing a Manchester accent for me, and she said, it's because they can't open their mouths very much because you work in the factory, so you keep your mouth shut.
Wow.
Same thing, I have friends in Ireland. Well, they'll say the way that you do it is as higher up you go, you drop it more, and it's wide, and then the lower you get, your mouth closes. Stuff like that, it's fascinating. It's fascinating.
And it does make sense, actually, even in America, just thinking about it now, you know, with in the South where it's very hot and it, you know, you kind of have to sprawl your mouth down and wide in order to get down.
Yeah,
there.
You relax
and
in
it's
a
lazy.
Way.
And then, you know, the further north you go and the colder it gets.
They're cold.
It suddenly gets into that kind of weird territory where your lips are close
really
together.
Yeah, really cold.
Yeah.
Oh, no. It's freezing.
It's a freezing snow Fargo country.
But that's it. Yeah, I love all of it. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Merton Park, which is southwest London. My family is still near there, quite near to where the Wimbledon tennis stadium is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was...
That's right. And did you go to drama school?
I didn't, actually. I finished school, I was always very young for any year groups that I did. And I was part of a theatre company from about 15 to 19 that was called the National Youth Music Theatre. Mm-hmm. And it was an extraordinary company. They did a sort of workshop production at my school. And I was really lucky that they did, because I genuinely don't think I would probably have gone into this profession had they not, because it was one of the first times that I've sort of picked out of anything, really. And I think that you don't really forget that if you're sort of singled out. It's hard. You know, I think every child grows up thinking, you know, you read, if you, especially if you're a reader of, getting back to fantasy or something, you think you're going to be that special Frodo or Harry or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And I think so on that first experience of being picked out, it is something that sticks with you, and it certainly did for me. And I auditioned for the bigger company and did that every summer for the next sort of 5 years. I devoted myself to it, really, to that company. And what was the question?
So you didn't go to drama school?
No, I didn't. I sort of finished school, and I was sort of quite young, you know, compared to everybody else. And so I took a couple of years to not, and I opened this newspaper, physical paper newspaper, in what they called The Stage, which was for many years in Britain how actors would find opportunities to audition for things if you, you know, didn't have agents, etc. And I joined the back of a 3-hour queue for something and ended up hosting a kids' TV show and recording a jazz album, singing with a big band with Simon Fuller, the music producer. And it all kind of ended up not really working out quite how I thought it would, but I was 19, so what does it matter? And then I sort of decided I wanted to go to college and study literature, which I did. And I studied drama at university as well, but like the history of drama rather than actual acting. But I would just direct a lot of plays and really feel, I felt, you know, that I'd had those couple of years to find myself a little bit, or find my groove a little bit anyway, of my confidence, because I was always, you know, the youngest person in the room. And I think that was good for me. So didn't end up going to drama school. Did audition for some drama schools, and I had some scholarships to go.
Yeah.
But in the end, sort of just decided I wanted something a bit more solid. My parents are the most extraordinarily supportive human beings on the planet, and I'm sure that every guest you've ever had on this show probably says something similar.
Nope.
Or maybe the exact opposite, I suppose.
No, we get some good ones.
But they weren't that keen on the idea of, you know, they had no barometer for what somebody going into acting was. No one in my family has ever done anything similar to this. Nobody who goes to the kind of, you know, British public school, all boys school that I went to, nobody does that kind of thing. So I mean, I had one careers meeting ever, and I said I was thinking about going to acting, and they physically laughed at me and gave me a pamphlet about being a barrister, which they thought was the closest thing.
Yeah.
But I did audition for drama schools. I actually got mugged. I went
on your way in or on your way out?
Halfway through.
During the audition, someone mugged
you. Yes, they did a full day audition for this theatre school called the Guildford School of Acting, which is incredibly, for musical theatre, it's sort of the British Juilliard, honestly. Yeah. It's a really wonderful place to go. I've had lots of friends actually who've been through that course. And you go in the morning and you do your singing and your Shakespeare monologue and everything, and then you get called back in the afternoon if you get through. It's a sort of like a, you know, a sort of cutthroat. Mm-hmm. Actually, a good experience for the business. But there was a pub next door to the theatre school, which I went to in the break to have lunch, and this man with this big orange beard came in halfway through and pulled a knife out and just pressed it against my side. And the pub was full. And he just looked at me and looked down at my wallet on the table. And I just looked at him and just did a shrug. Like, and he just took the wallet and walked out. And then I had to go back into the next portion was the interview portion, and I just burst out into tears in this thing, and I got a scholarship. I think for my sub story.
You hired that old rascal.
Yeah, right.
I did.
That's
scared
wild.
The bejesus out of me.
That story I must have pushed very far away because I don't think I've ever told it before.
But, oh my!
Yeah.
What an astonishing.
Yeah.
What a day that was.
Well, I couldn't believe that I didn't go to the school after that, yeah. You know.
So yeah. At what point in this journey, and it sounds like a beneficial journey, even the detours and such, did you have a rock group? You made music videos and you recorded?
Oh, well, the
Eurovision.
Eurovision. Oh, don't do it to me.
But it's so. First of all, Americans, for the most part, do not know what it is.
Which I'm thankful for.
But second of all, Eurovision.
I'm very, very thankful for that. No, we never made it quite that far. Yes, I was in sort of several. I was in a sort of function band, which played at some graduations and weddings and things. I used to screech my way through Stevie Wonder and Queen songs, And then I had this sort of boy band moment, which I was in this band for about 3 weeks, and
I guess you call that a moment.
A bunch of nightclubs, and we only had one song, and we sung it on television once as part of this Eurovision thing, and it was abysmal. And I watched it the next morning, at about 9 o'clock in the morning. I watched it. And at 9:04, I called the, very much in quotes, manager of the band and said, I'm not going to be doing this anymore. And he said, why not? I said, because it's unbelievably embarrassing and bad. And I think he said, fair enough or something. So that was that. But
he didn't fight you very
no,
hard.
But it's actually, the music side of things has come in extremely, you know, it's something I'm extraordinarily passionate about, not being in bands necessarily, but I love I'm a great lover of music, and I've managed to use it in quite a lot of film projects, not so much the TV stuff, but quite a lot of my film projects I sort of sing on the soundtrack or have been involved in that kind of way, which is it's been a very sort of precious part of the journey for me.
Well, it's so funny that you say jazz. So my dad's a jazz nut, always been. Raised me into a jazz nut. I went to school for jazz voice.
You did.
We're such music nerds. So of all the things, and big band and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So it's so funny.
Well, I played drum. My first professional job ever when I was 15, the first thing I ever got paid to do was to play the drums in a big band production of Bugsy Malone in the West End in London. That was, and so I would, amazing. I was at school and I would get to leave early, you know, on Wednesdays or whatever. I got to leave at 11 o'clock and I picked up my stick bag, my drum stick bag, and headed off into London to moonlight as a jazz drummer. And it was just, I struggle, the extraordinary ups and downs of my career so far, but I struggle to find a time which I think of more fondly than that time, you know, because I when you're a kid and you're made to feel like an adult, I don't know if there's many things more powerful than that. It's one of the most, and it was the 20-year anniversary of that production recently. So I actually hired a drum studio down the road from where we are now, and went in and pressed record and pressed play on the overture of the thing and tried to see if I could remember it, and just sort of played along with it and put it on the internet.
I love that.
Yeah,
that's so cool. What do you now, if it's just for fun, what are you generally doing music-wise? If it's for yourself, do you like to sing jazz? Do you like to play music in that way?
Well, singing is kind of one of my barometers for my happiness, I think. If I realize I haven't been singing to myself for a few days, I'm probably struggling with something, stress-wise or tension or whatever. I don't have a band or anything like that.
I just kind of plonk away.
Yeah, I just kind of plonk away very badly at my piano, and I pick up my guitar, which I learned to play for a film called Jackie and Ryan, which I did with Katherine Heigl, where I play a sort of street busker character. And I had very intensive lessons for that film because I didn't play the guitar. And so I picked that up and I play the sixth or eight things that are in that film over and over again, much to the chagrin of my anyone who, you know, roommates or anyone who happens to be staying with me at the time. I still, you know, I still torture myself with trying to perfect those, to be honest. But yeah.
That's so funny.
Wow. Well, turning the clock back again just a bit to your earliest experiences with film. Stardust was a pretty big production too.
Mm-hmm. That was my very first.
Yeah, and very first. So you didn't walk into, that was not a flea bit indie.
It was not. The flea bit indie came actually only a very few weeks afterwards. But I remember auditioning for the lead role in that part, which in that film, which Charlie Cox eventually played, who's a great friend of mine ever since. We've both been working on these Marvel Netflix shows, and we live in the same building. And I, yeah, exactly. So we're very, we're still very tight. And I was playing his dad, so I still will call him up and say, Charlie, it's your father. but it was a lovely way to be introduced to. It would have been a lovely way to be introduced to any job because I was the first, I think, 12 or 15 minutes of that film. But you were sort of the lead of the 12 minutes.
Right.
Right.
So it was, you know, the focus you had, you know, the focus was on you, which I think is an important thing to learn how to engage with.
Mm-hmm.
But not the pressure of being carrying the film or anything. Mm-hmm. And I remember my very first day on any film set ever. It was in the Midlands, I think, in England, and there was fake sort of snow, and we went into this sort of marketplace, which is one of the first scenes of the film, and there's monkeys in cages and crazy two-headed things and elaborate plants and wonderful character actors with extraordinary faces just sort of gawping at you, and I remember I hadn't met Matthew Vaughan yet, I don't think, but I was sort of ushered onto the set to look and be shown the path I would walk. And he just went, no, turn him around. And I got turned around and he goes, and then I met him and he said, the face you were doing looking at everything is the exact face I need you to do. So don't look at anything. Just wait till I roll the camera. And I've been trying to trick myself ever since,
in
every moment of every film, I don't like the feeling of being duped as an actor. I sort of think I'm a professional. I remember Tom Hanks saying, I pride myself on being able to put myself in any situation to trust me to do that. But tricking yourself is a whole different thing. So in order to trick myself that something is a real scenario or a real moment, then I'll do it. And that was my very, very first lesson in film, and I certainly, you know, use it all the time. You know, I try not to look at sets because you get these preconceived notions of how things should be. And, you know, if you need to shut a door and it's the door to your house, go and shut it 10 times so you know how to shut that door.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not the door to your house, don't touch it. Huh. Because you wouldn't. Then it'll feel natural. And it was my very first lesson. And sure enough, I think that when I look around that marketplace, that sort of slack-jawed, wide-eyed face that I'm doing is just natural kind of awe.
Now, did you even get to meet Michelle Pfeiffer or Robert De Niro?
I did not get to meet any of those people. I met... I remember meeting Claire Danes and Sienna Miller, which was the thing I was most interested in at the time, I think, as a 20-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not get to meet them, but I did get to work with De Niro
many years later.
Many, many years later, mm-hmm. In a sort of much more intimate setting. The film we worked on is dreadful, but
everything's an experience.
But everything's an experience, and I got to do a couple of scenes with just myself and De Niro, and one scene with myself, De Niro, and Diane Keaton, and they're playing my adoptive parents. And there's this one little moment in the film which I actually really do like, where he gives me a present, and it was extremely, extremely powerful, and he was extremely kind and supportive.
That's
nice to hear. That film was called The Big Wedding.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
It was. Yes, it was.
It came, it went, it happened.
It is the romantic comedy, save the comedy and the romance. but I think still one of the most extraordinary casts of any film ever to be put together.
Quite a roster.
I could not believe that I was allowed to be included on that list. And I got to work with Robin Williams, mm-hmm. Which he was always, you know, one of the true, you know, greats of... Mm-hmm. Our profession and film in general, and so to have that, I wouldn't change it for the world.
Of course not.
Well, that, you'll speak to people sometimes, and they'll say, "I did it so I could ride a horse. I did it so I could live in
New
Zealand."
But I got to watch the process of De Niro. I got to watch him go back into the corner and read his tome that he was reading about JFK, I think, in between setups. I got to watch Diane Keaton put her headphones in between takes and spin around dancing to salsa music and then just toss her iPod aside on the word action. I got to watch, I got to watch Robin Williams hold court, even if it's just three crew members in between to keep himself firing. I remember that the director came in and went, okay, Robin, Ben, Amanda, you guys can just feel free to just improv this one. Just say whatever you like. And I looked at him and he went, what? And I went, you're asking me to do improv with Robin Williams. That's like asking me to... That's like asking me to box Mike Tyson.
Right. Just go ahead. You're fine.
Just go ahead. And I remember saying some kind of line that I thought was really clever and funny. And so I thought, I'll do that again next take because that worked. But of course, he's 47 steps ahead of you. So he's moved on to something completely different. And you're thinking, I'm going to say my line again that I came up with. And that's when you just want to take your brain out and wash it and give it back and get a different one.
He was truly one of a kind.
Mm-hmm. He really was.
One of a kind.
At least we have lots and lots and lots of his work to stare at.
Yes.
Absolutely. It keeps you alive, doesn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. It really does.
Oh, yes.
But that's the thing about film that is fascinating is it's encapsulated. It's these moments, and it's exactly then. I always think about that for actors, how strange it must be to watch yourself age. To go from playing a young person to playing a father, whatever it is. We were talking. I just saw Halloween the other day, and I was saying to my dad, "It's a funny thing now to see Judy Greer playing a mom, because I remember seeing her in Jawbreaker back in the day, where she's this awkward, adorable girl."
Right.
And it's that kind of a thing where I'm starting to have the experience that they have, where someone suddenly playing a grandpa, and they're going, "No." No, you're not old enough to play.
So it necessarily has to move along with your life. But there's two sort of perspective steps to take back in terms of you are, when you're on film, all you're trying to do is capture real life, capture a moment of real life in a bottle and seal it up in order to present it. But it's not real life. But once it exists on film, that was how you spent those minutes of your real life too. So when you look back at it, you remember filming that take, and that's captured part of your real life. It's not quite like taking a photo of something you did as a tourist, mm-hmm. but I did spend my time doing that exact thing, pretending to be that in that moment, and that's real. So it does. It's capturing your life. It's like watching a home video of somebody as a kid.
I remember, speaking of Mr. De Niro, seeing Mean Streets, Scorsese's great, great early film, and I'd never seen De Niro before. And he plays a really loopy, loose cannon, I think is the best way to describe his character there. And I remember the theater I saw it in New Jersey, where I grew up, and being blown away by the movie and Harvey Keitel, but thinking that they must have found this guy on the streets of Greenwich Village or Little Italy.
Mm.
I didn't think he was an actor giving a performance. I just thought that he was that guy. I very quickly learned otherwise, but I'll never forget that reaction that I had to him the young Robert De Niro. And of course, I never failed to be impressed after that. But my gosh, you know, he's so brilliant. And I wonder, and you just answered the question for me, that even in a film like The Big Wedding, which was not a rousing success,
critically acclaimed box office smash hit, The Big Wedding.
Even in that,
in a blockbuster bin near you soon,
right. he committed to his role, to
absolutely,
his performance,
and was willing to take direction. I remember the director going over to him and saying, "Bob, the thing you're doing with your arms," and he went, "Oh yeah, of course, the arms. Forget the arms," and I was just, you know, just so willing, just thirsty for direction. It was interesting. I've worked with Keitel, actually, Harvey Keitel, actually, as well. I did another box office smash hit called "By the Gun," which I ended up actually sort of producing by way of giving back my fee in order that they could finish editing it.
Follow the money.
That's right.
Yes. No. I was supposed to exchange my fee in order for them to listen to how I sort of imagined the cut should be. They did not listen, and the, most of the criticism was about things that I said they should change, actually. But we're not bitter. I don't think it would have saved it. But I do remember on Harvey Keitel's last day, he was playing the sort of mob boss, who on his last day, I remember standing in Boston on these loading docks. And they said, "Oh, that's a wrap on Mr. Keitel," and the crew applauded. And he kind of did this gesture, like stop clapping. He goes, "Thanks a lot, guys. See you all in hell," and then just left. And I just thought,
Keitel out.
Keitel out. Drop mic. Peace. It was sometimes. So sometimes they do feel a little bit like
it's
like
all worth
in
it.
Real life how you imagine
that's
them.
Neat. That's really neat. A film you made that I'm very fond of is Killing Bono.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
It's a good movie.
Yes.
An odd but endearing little film.
It is strange. It was written by Dick Clement and Ian Lefrené, who wrote The Commitments,
right.
Which was
one of our favorite movies.
And one of my favorite ever movies. So I thought, well, this is a film I have to do. And I was actually on set in my trailer shooting The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the third Narnia movie, and I read the script in the trailer. And before I had finished reading it, I had ordered on Amazon Did Amazon exist then? Who knows? But I had ordered the book that it was based on. And I think 4 days later, I'd finished the book that it was based on, this very sort of self-deprecating memoir of this journalist called Neil McCormick, who I played in the film. This is a film about these two brothers who went to school with U2 and formed their own band, but their band was crap. And they spent the next, you know, 20 years trying to be a success like U2 and failing miserably. And it was played by myself and Robert Sheehan. And I remember... He's
so
fantastic and extraordinary talent. He's just sort of a bubbling talent, you know. It's just, he has electricity in his blood, I think. But... I remember shooting a day on Narnia and then driving an hour or two to Brisbane, which was the nearest sort of city, and doing a sort of Skype audition. And the director and Robbie were sitting on this big screen, but it was in one of those big conference rooms with sort of 20 seats down each side, and I was sort of sitting at the head of it, like the CEO of, you know, Mitsubishi or something. And I was reading, trying to do these comedy scenes in an Irish accent with my long Dawn Treader hair with at least a 7 second delay. And a comedy with a 7 second delay is no longer comedy.
No.
Or if it's funny, it's funny for very much the
right.
wrong reasons.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I just remember the back of my neck getting very hot, but thinking I have to be in this film. I get to do a silly Irish accent. I get to wear extraordinarily ridiculous, you know, 80s outfits and play a terrible rock star. And And it was just terrific. I got stuck in the accent though. I love the Irish accent so much. And I got stuck in it for about 2 weeks after filming. I couldn't get rid of it because I felt like everything sort of going back to what I said earlier, I felt like everything I said had more profundity and more zing in the punchline. And so I got stuck in it. And I remember sort of chatting with somebody at the time because I was going to do press for the Dawn Treader, thinking, do you think people are going to notice if I'm just Irish now? If I just sort of go on talk shows and just do
Irish.
It just works better for me, doesn't it?
Well, it's always funny. If you are someone who picks up on accents, you'll hear yourself doing it back to somebody. So things like, if you're in the South, you will hear yourself start to do things and you go, oh God, stop.
My mum does that, but she does it with even people who are sort of from Eastern Europe or somewhere, and you'll find her trying to, you know, the volume just going up and her accent just morphing into the accent of the person she's speaking to, and I'm shuddering.
I wish I could hear that. That sounds fun.
It's a thing. It's a thing that happens.
It's a thing that happens. People do it though. When you know.
You do it naturally though. You do it naturally. It's just sort of in response to things. Yeah. You start saying. I've also said though, with the Northern accent, because they leave letters off at the end, there are things you can't say in an American accent because they just sound stupid.
Yes.
So you know what they call sandwiches.
In America?
No, in the North. If you're in the North.
Oh, a sarnie or a butty.
Butty.
Yeah.
Now, when I say butty, that sounds about as dumb as it. So when I'm there, I'll just say butty.
That's not bad.
That's how my mother-in-law says it. That's how I say.
But the thing I always try to explain to my mom is speaking louder and in a terrible attempted version of that person's accent is not going to make you better understood.
No.
I do think it's apparent.
Nothing. I want you to put it there. No, that's much less comprehensible than you just saying it in your own accent at a normal volume.
My dad definitely does that. It's okay. He'll go a little French sometimes. He'll go a little Spanish sometimes.
There it is.
It's adorable.
Guilty.
It is
guilty
adorable
as charged.
Is what it is. It's
guilty
okay.
as charged.
Kind of like, I feel like as soon as you become a parent, you lose the ability to whisper. Like, I don't know how that happens, but like the second that baby pops out, you suddenly just start.
Are we into the oversharing moment of the show?
I'm just saying.
Just
if
wondering.
If you've ever sat between my parents at a movie.
Welcome to Parent Corner.
It's intense. It's an intense experience of both of them going, is that the guy from the thing? Yeah. Again, not bitter. That's the bit.
That brings to a close that segment of the show then.
As your child, I am allowed to mock you mercilessly.
Oh, that was Parent Corner.
Thank you so
with
much.
The Maltins.
Thank you so much.
That was my DJ voice.
So is your current jobs an attempt to take over streaming television entirely?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Punisher has got a huge audience.
Huge.
And Westworld, of course, is a big prestige production for that's HBO. It's not streaming. It's not streaming. It's HBO.
It's not television.
It's HBO.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. I started to sort of realize there was this sort of move, I think, in Hollywood. 7 or 8 years ago, where TV just went from something that you would watch, but you would, if you had been in film, you would think, well, if the film work dries up, I could audition for some TV.
Yeah.
And now it just very quickly changed and just almost has become the other way around, because the stories that I care about, the stories that I'm engaged with, the stories I want to tell, the stories I want to be involved in telling on, you know, that other people have created are on TV, and you get to tell these stories over 13 hours, and it's just so fulfilling, and it's what I watch, and I'm not ashamed of saying that I am a TV streamer, you know.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Same.
And,
yeah.
And
no embarrassment there.
No, but it's It's something that I just wanted to be involved with, and I sort of made myself a promise that I would take jobs that I would watch, because there were a few years in there where I took a lot of jobs that I thought might be worthwhile, but I wouldn't necessarily watch them myself. And I don't think that was a good sort of standard for me. And I started enjoying myself more. And I think actually making sort of huge leaps forward in my... I'm trying not to use the dreaded word craft, but...
But it is.
I took sort of leaps and bounds forward, I think, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when I started doing this, that kind of work, because the characters also are always being offered. I think also having spent 15 years playing these slightly earnest, sort of vaguely ambivalently heroic characters... I'd done enough of it in order for it to be interesting for people to see me subvert that. And right. I think that was much more enticing to me and came much more naturally to me. And it made me feel so much more confident and free to experiment and have fun.
So The Punisher certainly did that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That The Punisher... And what's been really extraordinary about the last couple of years is that I've done 2 seasons of each show, and I don't know if I can think of anyone else who's been given this kind of freedom, but I essentially played different characters in season 2 of each show from what I played in the first season. Because in Westworld, I get reinvented without meaning. You know, I don't want to sort of spoil anything for anyone who hasn't yet watched it, but. You know, you see in the first season a douchebag, essentially. a character who is entirely conceited and selfish and vain and has no regard for other people's happiness. And in the second season, you get to peel back the onion a little bit and see why. And it's actually in the second season, I think you get to see that about almost every character. Mm-hmm. They really flip every character around and... Or as if every character was a 3D model that you then turned around and looked at from a different angle. And so to be able to see the reasons why people treat others disrespectfully, the reasons why people act out, the reasons why people sort of make fun of other people is very often just, is very, very seldom just for the sake of it. So that was very interesting in terms of Westworld. And then in terms of The Punisher, the second season, is not out yet, but it's, you know, essentially I play a secret narcissist who is ex-special forces and whose face and mind are destroyed in the final episode of the first season, and so wakes up afresh. And I kind of actually had a pitch for it that it would be a kind of... like a sort of memento rebirth, you know, he wakes up every day and get that Guy Pearce performance is extraordinary. But, you know, wanting to see, you know, being given the opportunity to play a villain, of course, my instinct was, let me find all the things about this person that are not villainous. Let me find all the vulnerability. Let me find all the
contradictions.
The deep corners, exactly. Mm-hmm. All the contradictions. Let me take every stage direction where it says, you know, he screams and throws a chair. Maybe he curls up in a ball and cries. I don't know. But let's find the opposite. Let's find the truth of these little moments. I think that's what Netflix have been so extraordinary with in terms of these Marvel shows, is really putting 2 feet on the ground. If this person has suffered, you know, damage, let's see what that really feels like when you look in the mirror. If this person has suffered trauma, brain trauma, let's see what that really feels like, rather than some cartoon of it.
It is fascinating. We talk to people a lot about the switch in TV because it's so prominent, of course. And one of the things I love hearing is exactly that, which is, now, for a lot of actors, if you do something for 10 years, if you play the same character for 10 years, that can be a lot. And that can be too much at times, just because you don't get to play in the way you'd like to. At the same time, getting... 8 episodes, 12 episodes, whatever it is, 20 episodes and on, you suddenly get to know a character in a completely different way. And then there's everyone around you as well. It's just a really neat process, I think. And I love hearing exactly what you're saying, which is you got to do one thing and now you get to try something else, but it's the same show.
Well, I think that's actually almost the next step of TV, which yeah. is, which is, if you want to stay water cooler TV, you need to find a way to reinvent your show every 10 episodes mm-hmm. and look at it from a different angle. I think that's what Westworld have just shown an extraordinary potential for, in that, in, you know, the final episode of season two, a character disappears with a bag of consciousness, and you don't know who, if any, of the other characters that you've seen in the show thus far are going to be in the third season, and the actors don't know either. I mean, that's, and I think that's got to be a way to keep that medium fresh.
Yeah.
Which is very exciting.
It is. Exciting is the word, though. It's exciting.
I think
for the actors, it's exciting, which always makes us happy. We love that you're getting to play.
Yeah.
And it is, when you talk about craft, that too. It's a lot of different pieces. Seeing where they shoot here. So for anybody who doesn't know LA / the area around LA well, Santa Clarita is ranch country. And so you're driving and suddenly there are westerns and there are, you know, heists and all kinds of stuff happening out there.
Yep.
And then you watch it on TV and you think, what, are they in the Wild West?
Yeah.
No, they're down the street from CSI.
Yes.
But it all...
Although,
you know,
we do shoot a couple of weeks a year out in Utah, sort of Moab and the deserts and the Red Rocks, and it feels like Mars.
Mm.
I mean, it really does. It feels like... It feels elsewhere.
Yeah. Incredible. And there are two great casts.
Yeah.
You know, fantastic.
Amazing.
People.
Yeah, John Bernthal is, is you know, an acting beast.
He's finally getting... the attention he deserves.
He is. He's got an extraordinary tension in him as an actor. You know, he's got this kind of this competing, loving, huge-hearted, generous, leading family man. You know, and then this sort of this bear, ex-boxer, you know, violence in him, and they're competing in him as a man. And I think that especially in this character, you see those things at odds with each other, and you almost don't need tension in the scenes because you have tension in his body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing to be opposite. And my job was to find a way to be the counterpart to that.
Mm-hmm. You know? And then the marquee names on Westworld are, you know, pretty imposing. Yeah. Starting with, he doesn't like to be called Sir Anthony Hopkins. He's apparently not. No. He's a naturalized American citizen now.
Yes.
And he's proud of it. So he's just Anthony Hopkins. And God bless him.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey Wright. And
Jeffrey is wonderful. I've not had the pleasure of meeting Sir Anthony. I didn't have any scenes with him, but I did manage to have some scenes with Jeffrey Wright, who is... Mm-hmm. I mean, just an extraordinary talent. I think he's got this way of making you feel like you're inside of his head, inside his brain, but you're there, but you don't know what's happening, which is a really interesting dichotomy. You know, I think you watch the second season of Westworld, you feel like you're in his brain, but you're lost. And that, I think, is such a specific thing. I'm sure, and I don't know whether he set out to play that, but he's really something.
Incredible. And... Are you someone that wants to write? Are you someone that wants to direct? Are you someone that wants to try that?
I've certainly had hankerings to do directing, I think, because the truth is the director is the person with the answers, and it doesn't matter if they're right or not. I think that there's that sign at Pixar, if you go in, that says, you know, something like, be wrong as fast as you can. Just doesn't matter what the answer is. Doesn't matter if it's right. You can change it late. But just have an answer, basically. Essentially, have an answer. And I think that I've got to the stage, having been on sets after 15 years, where I have an answer. And very often I sort of watch what's going on and think, well, I would do this. And then that's what happens. And I think, oh, well, that's good. I've learned something, you know. I definitely feel, you know, passionate about, you know, making something going forwards, but I lose confidence in ideas that I've written very quickly. And I think, you know, if you're going to see something through as the captain of a ship, it has to be something that you are totally certain about.
Of course.
Start with a short.
Exactly.
Start with a short.
Exactly.
Where you feel confident.
Yes.
And go from there. You can do it.
But it's also a little bit sort of, you want to get really, really, really good at one thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, as I say, I feel like I cracked open a door 4 or 5 years ago in terms of the acting, and we'll see how many more doors there are there too. I think because I always think that the actors that I really love, I look back at their early work and think, oh, yeah, but they were always magnificent, you know.
For instance,
well, the thing that just popped into my head was This Boy's Life.
Extraordinary.
DiCaprio, which
is extraordinary.
One of his best performances, actually, I think.
Yes.
But that's just one example. But if you look at early Robert De Niro or Michael J. Fox, or, you know, Back to the Future is probably my favorite ever film. But you look at any of those, you look at young Paul Newman, young Robert Redford, any of those very young early performances, young Brad Pitt, young Denzel, they were always that. They were always electric in that way. And sometimes I look back at my own stuff and say, yeah, well, I had a lot to learn. And I think I was always like that with everything. With academia, I was always like that. I didn't understand things quickly, but I spent a really, really long time working at them, trying to get good at them, and I want, you know, I'm interested to see how far I can take that, because I, you know, I feel now in a quite confident place compared
to great.
And you have 15 years ago, and you have
not one but two interesting vehicles in which to try things out,
explore that. And then, as I said, I've gone back to playing British for the first time in 10 years because that's something that I felt ready to do, as it were. So I'm working on a BBC drama with Julia Ormond, who is a wonderful actress from many wonderful films that I watched growing up.
Yep.
You know, Sabrina and Legends of the Fall and First Night, and so I'm working on a love story between myself and her called Gold Digger.
Yes,
for the BBC.
Typecasting, right?
Yes, exactly. But looking for those opportunities to really explore and push myself and you know, see what I'm capable of.
You're a young man. Directing can wait.
Exactly. That's
writing
what I
can
think.
Wait. Keep exploring, as you say, and keep the eye on the prize.
Exactly.
Well, just to be the best actor you can be, and obviously that's what you're striving for.
Absolutely. And my parents, my father was a professor of schizophrenia, is a psychiatrist. My mother is a relationship psychotherapist. So they have sort of devoted their lives to seeing how the mind, how the brain, my dad, how the brain, my mum, how the mind work, and helping other people with figuring out how they think. And I think that is something that I have kind of inherited in a way. It's just mine is more hypothetical. How would I feel in this situation? And that, to me, is the lure of what I do. And I want to know. I may not have experienced this specific trauma. I may not have experienced this specific joy. But I have things in my life that have happened to me that I can relate to this moment. We've all felt fear. We've all felt ecstasy. We've all felt that feeling of being disabused or lonely or whatever, and you can relate those things and extrapolate them and exaggerate them and really find out what it might feel like to be in this scenario now, and that, convince myself that this is a real thing, or trick myself that this is a real thing, you know. And I think that's where the magic of the job lies for me. That's what excites me about it, and telling stories that really explore how different people approach the same life, the same minutes that we're all granted on this planet. How do we use them? And how do different people react to different things and use those minutes and those moments? Because film is all about stitching together little truthful moments.
Right. That's what we think that way about the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Stitching together little truthful moments.
But everything you just said, though.
It's absolutely right. This father and daughter sitting, having these lovely, you know, and you can cut them up. You've got these little separate hours that you guys have shared together with various guests in this cozy space. And you can look back on each of those, and you have them, you know, not on celluloid, but you have them to access. I can click my phone and access any of those things, yeah. and I will be able to do that for many, many years to come.
Yeah. No, it's exciting. Everything you just said, though, you are a writer and a director. You absolutely will be, 100%. And then you just did a recording book, audiobook.
I did.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, that's a deep Google dive you've done.
That's our beloved Jeffrey Chasson.
Oh, I see.
He told me that he's very excited for you.
I see. Well, yes, I've done a couple of them, but there was they're not particularly lucrative things to do. But I listened to a lot of audiobooks growing up. Mm. I listened to actors like Richard Briers. I don't know if you know that older British actor, but he...
A favorite of Kenneth Branagh's.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely a favorite. It was in that Much Ado About Nothing film.
We're a family of Anglophiles.
Right, so. Perfect. That helps me in this moment. But I would listen to those kind of actors read, you know, Roald Dahl or... Mm-hmm. I think it was a Roald Dahl that Richard Briers did. But they stick with you and you think, I would like to do that for... whoever's listening to books on tape now, which is a lot more people than when you were listening to the cassette and it would stop and you would open it and twist it round for side B and put it in and you'd be told to turn it off and go to sleep. And you're like, but I have to do side B. And so, something that I've always thought was quite a romantic idea in my head of sitting in a booth with a cup of tea. And actually, that's exactly what I did. And I recently had the opportunity to record a Zadie Smith, who is
right.
a wonderful author of books like White Teeth, and they re-recorded all her catalogue so far, and I voiced actually an extraordinary amount of characters with different silly voices in a book called The Autograph Man, and so I recorded that, and it was exactly that experience, you know.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's a really fun and safe feeling way to, like you were saying, explore how do I turn myself between second to second having a conversation as a half Russian, half Americanized 80-year-old ex-Hollywood starlet having a conversation with a British Asian character who is desperate to get her autograph and a third sort of divine brown type character. And those three are having a conversation. You're switching second to second between those voices.
Wow.
And it's on the page in front of you, but it's very pure storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody has written a story and you are sitting in front of a microphone, very much how we are now,
yeah.
telling that this story to someone. And actually, part of my thought process of doing that was actually because my mum cannot sit through The Punisher, of course. it is not her jam. I think she got through about 10 minutes of it. So I was thinking, oh, well, I'll do something that she can actually listen to.
Well, that's like parents who do kids' movies because they realize...
Mom, here's the new Zadie Smith novel.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
I would love to have done that, but I didn't write it.
But that is it. It's something that you can share in a different way. And the Audible book, my mom she loves it. And she's an early adopter. She'd pick me up from school and have one blasting. You'd get in the car and God knows what was just being, you know.
Well, that's not fair to land you in the middle of a chapter.
You get used to it after a while. But she's really been into it for a long time.
Yes,
and it's gotten both of us into it from that.
Mm.
And listening to things, like I remember when she listened to Harry Potter. And
she listened to both.
The Stephen Fry ones?
Both. Yeah, Stephen Fry and Jim Dale. She switched back and forth.
I'm
between
such
them.
A Stephen Fry fan. He's one of my favorite
he's
ever.
He's magic.
Humans. He's magical.
I love him.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that, you know, she listened to those and got us into it because it is something my parents read to me when I was little to go to sleep.
Mm.
Just in general, too.
Yeah, well, my dad would do very silly voices at me. I think that's where my sort of love of doing voices came from. So anyone who gets sick of me doing, you know, Stewie from Family Guy every given opportunity, anyone who gets sick of that they can blame him.
I would love to hear you as Stewie, but that's...
Oh, would you? Mummy.
like a dancing monkey again. And I love it. You know, we love accents and all those sorts of. It's another creative side. It's fun to play.
Ben, in wrapping up, are you a social mediaite?
I congratulate you, sir, on the use of the word mediaite, which I have never heard before and am now going to use daily. Yes, I did. I started them much, much, much too late. I was rebelling heavily against it. Because I just think that, you know, some things should be private. But then I think, you know, if there are 17 people pretending to be you, that's not fair. That's not fair on people. So even if I am a little bit lazy in terms of updating it, I do now. I do the gram. Is that you can call it that?
Yeah, that's what the kids call Instagram.
Yeah, I got that. Got that. Picked up on that.
Yeah.
I Twitter.
You Twitter. Part of why I started him accounts in 2009 was because we had exactly that with a bunch of fake ones. There's still one that exists that I love though, called Angry Leonard Maltin. And it's just like, and he doesn't barely tweets, but every now and then it's just like, all movies are terrible. And in my mind, that's his secret account that like he never tells anyone he has. That's the whole thing.
Because you're always very kind.
Yep. Yes. And then he's just got Angry Leonard Maltin going, everything is awful.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Stop making remakes.
But I think that's an ode. That's an honor because they're saying you're one of those people who is passionate and loves film, and therefore it's funny to show you the opposite.
Angry Leonard Maltin is adorable and hilarious. Yeah. Yes.
Adorable and hilarious.
That's you.
Remember, you heard it here. And we just heard Ben Barnes for the last hour. So what a treat to talk to you,
Ben.
Thank
you so much for having me. It's been lovely.
Continued success with all of your endeavors.
Thank you.
And there are many.
Audiobook, working with Julie Ormond, The Punisher, and Westworld, and all the other things that you're going to be doing. And if you need to find out where to get any Cadbury or anything like that, I've got some hookups. If you need some Iron Brew or whatever, I'm just saying.
Thank you.
You're over here. You need a fix. I got it. Cheese and onion crisps.
Put the bunny back in the box.
It's a pin I'm wearing. We do. Ben and I, our relationship, we just like to quote Nicolas Cage to each other, is a thing we've discovered today. So, oh, wow. Thank you.
Thank you.
And where do they find us?
You can find us at Jesse Maltin, at Leonard Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. And you can go to leonardmaltin.com for book roundups and movie reviews and all kinds of good stuff.
And now we even have merch.
We do. You can get our faces on things. Also, not our faces on things, because I don't think I'm going to wear my face. I already am. But yes, you can get Tee Public, Maltin on Movies. Mm-hmm. You can get Little Leonard's.
And other things, yes. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next week. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.